Hi there, Good Word fam. Thank you so much for joining us. You know, it's Tisha Lewis here, and we are doing our podcast, The Good Word. It's a faith-based podcast. And typically, pre-coronavirus pandemic, we were in the Fox 5 DC podcast studios, but I am home and you joining us. I'm so thrilled we finally can make this happen. Is Prince George's County State's Attorney, Aisha Braveboy. State's Attorney Braveboy, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you so much for being here. I know that we've been in conversations to have this conversation for quite some time, but thank you for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure, and I'm so grateful to be a part of this show.
Absolutely. So as I mentioned off the top, we are a faith-based podcast, but we have something for everyone. We hope to inspire and encourage and uplift. And obviously, you know, people could use all of the above right now. It's trying times across the country. The DMV is no exception. Let's talk about, you know, you are a woman of faith. I'm a woman of faith. Share with me a little bit about how your journey has been and how your faith has impacted your career.
Well, I have to tell you, my faith has really directed my career, I would say. You know, I wasn't sure when I was in college what I wanted to major in. And I was just taking classes that were of interest to me. And then I took a class actually taught by Donna Brazile. And I was not aware at that time of how powerful she was and how significant she is to the Democratic Party and to our country generally. But she was one of the pioneers, a woman in politics, helping to direct elections and campaigns. And she taught a class on Blacks and the Voting Rights Act. And through that experience, I read a lot of case law dealing with voting rights, obviously. She introduced us to a lot of really amazing people, speakers who would come to our class to talk about their experiences with voting. And I just got a love for reading case law. And I was like, wow, I want to fight for justice for people, you know, like so I was really moved by taking that class. And I said, you know what, I want to be a lawyer. So it was the excitement that I felt inside of me when I was learning about the struggles and those who fought to give a voice to the voiceless. And I said, I want to be a part of that. And not only do I want to be a lawyer, I want to go to the greatest civil rights institution, Howard University School of Law. So when I was able to get into Howard, I was so grateful. And, you know, I took that experience and I just, you know, it was an awesome experience. And again, but coming out of law school, I still didn't know what direction I wanted to go in. And I let my faith lead me first into telecommunications, which I really did enjoy. But then I had an opportunity to come work for Prince George's County government. And I said, you know what, I think this is the right opportunity. And I guess the rest is kind of history in some respects, because I continue throughout my career to allow God to guide me. I pray a lot. and I also listen a lot. And then I make decisions on my next steps.
You know, you said that you pray a lot, and I have to ask you, because of course I'm a journalist at heart, and this mm-hmm. podcast is a wonderful opportunity to talk about faith, but I also want to talk about the prayers that you're saying right now, because we are in a climate right now, post George Floyd, where the racial tensions across the country are very high. There are calls to defund the police department. Mm-hmm. There are calls for police reform in mm-hmm. Prince George's County. Where yes. are you with all of that?
You know, I'm on the front lines. I think that there must be reforms and there should be reforms. And the reality is not everyone agrees with me. You know, not everyone in the public safety community wants to see reforms, and certainly not some of the what they may consider more radical reforms that are being proposed. But the reality is we cannot stay where we are. We must all do better. And while George Floyd and that incident happened in Minneapolis, the reality is just months before we had the murder of a civilian at the hands of a Prince George's County police officer who we are now in the process of prosecuting. So the reality is things that happen in America happen here in Prince George's County. We are affected and we need to, you know, respond to it. And so you can't be afraid. And as being in my position, you know, my position is considered the top law enforcement office. My belief is that I have to be courageous. So my faith teaches me to be courageous, and that it's going to be okay, and that there will be naysayers. There will be people who want you to fail. There'll be people who will want to question your judgment. But, you know, God put me in this position, I believe, for such a time as this. And you need courageous leaders willing to just speak truth to power, to do the right thing, listen to everyone. I'm not saying I have all the answers, but what I'm saying is that I'm in a position to create that change. And I am not going to shirk my responsibilities. I'm going to live up to my responsibilities.
What does reform look like though in Prince George's County? What does it look like differently than what's been operating as the status quo?
Well, really what it looks like is really the changing the mindset from just law enforcement to problem solving. And sometimes that problem solving may be that a person needs to be arrested and prosecuted. In other instances, people may need a more compassionate approach. And I'll give you an example. My office, about a year, maybe a little over a year ago, decided that we did not want to prosecute individuals charged with prostitution because oftentimes they are victims either of human trafficking or of just life circumstances. And so, so we created a diversion program where individuals who were charged with prostitution, they are first triaged by our Family Justice Center to find out what their needs are. And then we have three community-based programs that we can refer them to so that they can receive the services that they need. And they can get a case manager and an advocate, people who will help make them whole. And that was important to me. We're now looking at doing something very similar for people who are charged with things like trespass and fourth degree burglary, which is breaking into an unoccupied space. Oftentimes, these are people who are homeless. They're people who are addicted. And so when you have people offending in a community, but you understand that these people need help, the answer isn't always to prosecute. The answer oftentimes is to show compassion and help guide them in the right direction. And it takes a lot more maybe work, a lot more focus to do that, because it's easier to prosecute someone than it is to say, you know what, this person needs help. Let me try to figure out how we can help them. But that is our job. That is our role. And so looking at ourselves as a problem solver is important. Now, let me tell you, there are people who commit very serious offenses, murder, rape, child abuse, domestic violence. The appropriate response in those cases is to arrest, is to prosecute, is to seek significant sentences based on the offense. But the reality is the majority of people who come into contact with the criminal justice system have very minor or misdemeanor charges, which means we have an opportunity to make a difference in their lives.
You mentioned, you know, showing compassion for some of the nonviolent crimes, and I can't imagine that that's a popular position in your position and in your field and in your industry. And I'm assuming that is a position that is guided by your faith and by your belief and by your background and your conviction. How do you bring folks on board with that? And what are some of the biggest challenges that, you know, you face as, you know, the top law enforcement officer in Prince George's County, but also being someone who is guided by your faith and someone who is a believer and someone who believes in second chances and redemption? How do you bring folks on board when maybe they don't see it that way?
Yeah, well, my faith teaches me and tells me that it is possible to bring them on board. And that is why, you know, I do my best to, you know, show them through example. So when we initially talked about the the diversion program for commercial sex workers, it was not necessarily met with applause, right? But once we started doing it, our law enforcement partners saw the benefit of it, and they got on board, you know? And so similarly, we're going to model other what we think are smart strategies to deal with some of the offenses in our community. And my hope and my faith teaches me that it is possible for people to have their minds changed. But I also know that in my role as top law enforcement officer, if I move in a certain direction, that's the way the system is going to have to move. And I'll give you an example. We decided about a year ago that we were no longer going to prosecute just for mere possession of marijuana. Not possession with intent to distribute, like if you are a drug dealer, but just having possessing marijuana. Again, that was not met with open arms by many of my partners in law enforcement, but we sat down with them. We said why we had to make this policy change, why we thought it was the best thing for our community. And the reality is they understood, many of them. Some didn't agree, but arrests are down for possession. Those cases where there are arrests, we just dismiss those charges. And so everyone understands that this is the new standard here in Prince George's County. So again, while I would love for everyone to agree with decisions I make, they don't have to agree. Sometimes it's going to be what it's going to be.
What prayer does someone who is in your position say at the end of the day?
I always say at the beginning of the day, this is the day that the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it. And I'm so grateful every single day to have this position. But I think it is, and I'm trying to remember the exact verbiage, but I know it's Matthew 5:10, and it talks about people being persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And I think that's what you have to believe if you have the courage of your convictions. Even if there are people who are opposed to you or who are against you, if you have the courage of your convictions, you just stand tall and stand in your truth. Mm-hmm. And so that also helps me as I do this job.
What's been the hardest moment for you as state's attorney? Have you ever, I'm sure you have, but what's been a moment where maybe what you had to do for your job caused you some type of internal conflict with your faith and what you maybe personally believed?
Well, I don't know that I've had that challenge, but I can tell you that it is tough to when I have to meet with next of kin of murder victims. I can tell you that is probably one of the hardest things that anyone would ever have to do. I don't envy the officers who have to make, those calls or go to those homes to inform families that their loved ones are no longer here. And it was initially very difficult because I was very emotional. They're emotional, I'm emotional.
Everybody's emotional.
Everyone's emotional. Mm-hmm. But I realized that the sadness that I feel and the hurt and the pain that I'm witnessing, I can't even begin to imagine how they feel every single day. So while I feel like it has affected me, and I think families want to know that you care. So I think, me expressing, my emotions appropriately, I think that's, but recognizing that they are at, in many cases, the lowest points of their lives. And they're looking to me and to my office to deliver justice. We know that the only justice that they would really want is to have their loved one with them. Mm-hmm. And short of that, we have to, in some way, give them some semblance of justice that they can feel that their loved one's death was not in vain. And to be able to express that to families, to earn and gain their trust at that point in their lives, that's tough. It takes a whole lot of faith. I definitely pray before I go into those meetings because I want God to give me the strength so that these families will understand how much we will fight for them, how much we care for them, how much we want to know about their loved one who's no longer with us so that we can try to make sure that they are represented appropriately in the courtroom. That has challenged me, but I tell you, it has been the most rewarding part of the job is to gain that trust of families. So I would say that, but to your other question, I have never felt like I've been in a position where I felt like in any way the duties of my job have been compromised my faith.
Which is wonderful. It's wonderful to hear that. You've done so much work with young people, and I know that this is something that is near and dear to your heart.
Yes.
Juveniles, young people, minors, kids, our children. You have, you know, truly championed for them, and it's something that's so important because I think often they can get caught up in the system very easily. Any young person can. You make one wrong decision, and next thing you know, you are in the court system, and you are a firm believer in second chances. What can you tell us about why that's so important to you?
Literally, our children are our future, right? Before I came here to the state's attorney's office, I was actually the manager of government affairs at Children's National Hospital. And through that experience, I met with some of the greatest doctors and scientists in the country and those who specialize in our young people. And what we know and what science tells us is that the human brain continues to develop until about the age of about 26. And during that period from about 0 to 26, if there is trauma that is introduced to that young person, their brains will develop differently. And as a result of, of trauma, of what's called adverse childhood experiences, there is a 12 or 13-year-old child who has a quote-unquote normal development without the trauma, has certain sensibilities at a certain age. But when you introduce trauma into that child's life, their frontal lobe develops slower and their impulse control is different. And oftentimes they're very angry, they have loud outbursts, they're more susceptible to, having peer pressure, encourage what they do. And those young people are more likely to end up in our criminal justice system. And so what we also know is that even though they have been introduced to trauma, if they are then introduced to positive influences, that also helps their brain develop more normally. So that intervention, that diversion that we push, that's combined with intervention, can be so critically helpful and important to our children. So I don't believe there are throwaway children. That's what I believe. None of our children are throwaways. And so we're going to give them every opportunity to get it right. And that's why I push diversion so hard. That's why we have a mentoring program. We also work with our with clinical-based providers who can provide individual counseling and family counseling. And so we've seen fewer and fewer of our young people prosecuted as a result of the interventions that we are doing. Now, some of our kids commit very serious offenses. We've even had kids commit murders. So, you know, we have to look at the nature of the charges and the history of that child when determining whether or not we're moving forward with a prosecution and whether or not we would seek a period of incarceration. But most of our children are not committing crimes that serious. And so we do have a lot of opportunities to give them other options for their lives.
So, you know, State's Attorney, you mentioned your diversion program and, you know, your belief in second chances. And I think it's important to note, you know, there's an adage that says it all starts at home. But there's a lot of stakeholders and key players that are a part of the picture. What more can the churches do? What more can the schools do? What more can, you know, the community groups do before it gets to the point where you are looking at, you know, charges on your desk and then trying to determine if this young person qualifies for a second chance, for a diversion type?
Absolutely. Well, I think, you know, one of the great places that can really help us and aid and guide us is our schools. Children are required to go to school. And so the schools typically know which children are struggling. In fact, I've spoken to teachers who've had children who end up in the criminal justice system, and they would say, you know what, you know, Johnny, you know, I could tell he had some things going on with his life. I'm not surprised. You know, I'm saddened, but not surprised. And so what I think we have to do is really work in our schools to create an atmosphere where if a child does get into trouble, that doesn't mean that automatically they come to, you know, the criminal justice community, but that we have some restorative justice practices in our schools, that we have more counseling in our schools. We recently signed an MOU with the school system so that when there are offenses, although, I mean, you know, since they're not going to be in school.
Right. I was, you know, it's funny, as you were saying that, I was thinking in my mind, everybody's, you know, doing this distance learning thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, it'll be interesting to see it's too early to tell what the impact will be for our young people. But yes, times are completely different.
Yes, but when they do return, if there are offenses in the school, if they are not what we might consider serious offensive, if it doesn't involve a weapon, things like that, there are certain mechanisms, including community conferencing and other kind of peer mediation that can happen right in our schools without institutionalizing young people or creating records for young people. But that through those restorative practices, number one, they can make amends with the school and the victim that they offended, but then they can also be restored right back into their school so they can get that counseling. They can have those peer mentors who can help guide them in a better direction. And to me, that is going to be more effective in the long run, because what I have seen is that when a young person offends and they're put through the system, they're likely to end up back in the system. That's just the reality of it, because we look at their records. And so a lot of the young people, and they are very young. Now, they're not juveniles, but they are young. I'm talking about 18, 19, 21, 22, 23. They are the ones that are committing the majority of our very violent crimes, including murder, armed carjackings, and all of the, many of them, most of them have juvenile records.
Right.
So what I would say is that there was something that the system missed. There was an opportunity to intervene when they committed a less serious offense.
Sure.
That did not happen. And now we're back and they've committed a more serious offense.
So I want to ask you, you know, we ask everybody who comes on the Good Word podcast, thank you for coming on.
Absolutely.
I want to ask you, you know, to share with our listeners and folks who are maybe listening on iTunes and Audioboom and Google Play and watching, you know, this Zoom, it's all very different now. But I wanted you to share what is the good word?
Okay. So wait. Okay, you got to explain it to me again. So the good word
is the good word. What is the message that you would like to leave with people who are listening to this, people who are amid trouble and trying times and need something to uplift them, encourage them, inspire them?
You know, I think what I would say is that you are stronger than you think. You are stronger than you think. That's what I would say is the good word. I have to tell myself that almost every day.
Because I'm now going to tell myself that every day. Huh? I said, I'm now going to tell myself that every day.
Absolutely, because there's always a challenge that you got to face. And like today, I mean, just in small things, right? Like I was out walking my dogs and I said, oh my gosh, it's so hot. I think I'm going to turn back around. But I said, but you know, I wanted to do one more mile. And I said, you know what? I want to push myself. I think I can do this extra mile. Mm-hmm. And you know what? I could. And it was fine. Now the dogs weren't as happy as I was, but no, they were happy. They like to be out. But in everything that you do, when you think in your mind you can't do it, just say, no, I'm stronger than I think. You know, I'm more powerful than I think. Mm-hmm. And it is very true. And when you start acting in your power and in your strength, mm-hmm. You will move mountains. You will do things that you never thought you could do. But the reality is it was always within you. You were the only one holding yourself back.
And I don't even think I can top off what you just said. State's Attorney Aisha Braveboy, thank you so much for joining us on the Good Word Podcast. Folks, if you're listening, be sure to subscribe on iTunes, Audioboom, and Google Play. We are, I forgot what the stats are right now, but we're doing very, very well. We also have a Facebook group. That's a robust Facebook group. Just go to facebook.com and search The Good Word. State's Attorney, thank you so much again for joining us. We appreciate
it. Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate you.